Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and pleased to welcome our first guest today, David Shee. David is a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He has a new book out. It's called Chinese Prodigal, A Memoir in 8 Arguments. It's a dandy book, and I hope you join in as we talk with him. What comments do you have about bridging two cultures? Give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And Professor David Shee, welcome to the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Tell you what, this is a fascinating book that you've written. I really enjoyed it. It's a different kind of memoir from many I've read, and kind of a series of essays in a way. And the memoir is, the subtitle is A Memoir in 8 Arguments, and I'm wondering why arguments?
Oh, yeah, sure. So I think we can classify the book genre-wise as what's called a memoir in essays, as you describe. And it's an offshoot of the traditional memoir, where each chapter can stand on its own. And they're all kind of connected. They're connected by the thread of the story of my relationship to my father. But the word arguments means that I'm simply trying to write about my life to make a point in every chapter, to make a point about Asian American identity and about race in America in general. And so I'm hoping that readers will be open to thinking differently about race and racism when they read each chapter, you know, which they can do one at a time in almost any order. And, you know, I'm hoping that they give them a new way of thinking about themselves, as writing them did for me.
Yeah, well, it certainly did for me as well. Did the book start this way? Is that what you had in mind all along?
Yes, pretty much. So the book started right after the death of my father in 2019. And in order to kind of deal with the circumstances of his death, which, you know, I think were unusual in that I wasn't able to make it back to Texas from Wisconsin to see him, even though I had a couple of weeks to do so, I needed to deal with the sense of guilt and shame that came along with that situation. And so I wrote the first chapter about that story. But I also felt like I couldn't tell my own story without talking about other people and events. And I'm not necessarily talking about people that I know personally. I'm talking about people I haven't really met, some of whom aren't with us anymore. And so in that way, the book is a less traditional memoir. Because to understand the kind of person I become, I needed to think about what race had to do with it. And that meant writing about people and events that I wasn't acquainted with, because those people and events really shaped the dominant meanings of Asian people in the country. So I knew that if I wanted to talk about what it meant to be a Generation X Chinese American man, I had to include the story of Vincent Chin, yeah. which is chapter 3. That when you're somebody like me, what Vincent Chin meant to the Asian American community is inextricable from my identity, at least.
Yeah, I want to talk about Vincent Chin in a moment. I just wonder. The relationship with your father that you write about, boy, you really had me thinking hard about my relationship with my own father.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like you were being kind of brutally hard on yourself. There was a lot of regret in some ways in your writing about your dad.
Yeah, absolutely. I say in the introduction to the book that the book comes relatively late in my career. I'm 53. And so this is my first book, and I think it did because I wasn't ready to tell the truth about myself. Very simply, what assimilation had done to me, which had everything to do with my not being there for my father. And I felt like I had to be that brutally honest in the first chapter in order for the rest of the book to be true, if that makes sense. That is, if I can kind of admit to something and understand why it happened, then, you know, telling the rest of the stories, or at least most of them, became a lot easier. So I think, you know, I'd grown up wearing a lot of disguises. You know, the people that I wanted to be, the people that I hoped that others who were important to me wanted to see. And that first chapter basically says that that I'm done with that, and I wanted to be truthful to myself and to my reader.
Yeah, it must have been hard to write about that subject and the rest of them as well, to be perfectly honest.
Mm-hmm. I would say the most difficult chapters would be the ones about the people I care about the most, which are my parents and my wife and son. Because there are chapters about falling in love with and marrying a white woman, my wonderful wife, Robin, and then our decision to have a mixed race child together, my terrific son, Jacob. But actually kind of talking about how I believe love works, and especially interracial love works in this country, was especially difficult because we have this very romanticized notion about what love is. And I had to admit that race had everything to do with the history of our relationship and to attraction and desire.
Yeah. And your discussion, your writing about your son and what you had to think about with your son. I was thinking about my own daughters, and I had a completely different set of things to think about, I think, from you in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's the second chapter. And I didn't want to repeat the mistakes that I had made as a child with my own son, but I, you know, reflecting upon you know, his early life, I kind of realized that I was making certain decisions that I think, you know, could have led to an assimilated life for Jacob, where we decided to live, for example, you know, in Eau Claire or what we named him. You know, I also had to admit that, you know, he presented much more like a white kid when he was born than as a Chinese kid. Robin, my wife, is white. And I had to admit that that I was proud of his looks, that I liked the way that he looked. And I had to reflect upon why that was. My father certainly loved the way that Jacob looked. But, you know, I used the story of my family to talk about larger issues and topics that I think could be useful and interesting to other people. I'm glad to hear you say, Larry, that it was for you in that regard, because, you know, raising a mixed race child like my son made me reflect and think deeply about mixed race identity in our society. And I guess I'll make just one point about it, which is that I think too often when we talk about mixed race people, when we do so, we end up talking about race itself and not as much about racism, which tends to be par for the course, that I don't think we have as much of an issue talking about race as we do with racism. And I would like to shift the conversation more to the latter.
Our guest today, David Shi, his book is titled Chinese Prodigal, A Memoir in 8 Arguments. Questions or comments for him as we move along? Hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us. The email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Well, the whole business about assimilation, you know, this is going to probably sound weird to you, but I don't know if you ever watched Star Trek way back when.
Yes.
But I remember the Borg. And the Borg were always tried to assimilate the Star Trek crew or any other race that they happen to come across in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was horrible at the time. And assimilation in your mind, I don't know if you call it horrible. What would you call it?
I would just call it something that is, that we should all kind of accept that it's going to happen in ways that we may not see or recognize as being harmful. You know, I'll say that a lot of the book was that when I was a kid, I loved school. Right. I loved learning English. I loved everything that I read. And in all those ways, right, I was being, you know, assimilated to a particular culture. And the rub is that, you know, the distance, you know, toward that assimilated identity that you go, it takes you that distance away from your family, you know, who don't speak as English as well, for instance. My parents, we came from Hong Kong. I arrived in this country when I was one. So they both spoke English, but not nearly as fluently as I did. And so I wanted the book to talk about assimilation, to make a point about racism. And I think maybe one of the central points in the book is that racism isn't always about hate.
Yeah.
Right? That it can be, obviously. But I'd like for readers to think about racism more as social advantage. And so advantage for white people, certainly, but also for a lot of middle-class Asian Americans like me. And so, you know, assimilation would be that form of racism. And I think it's so difficult for us to separate the word racism from hate. So even when I say that, it seems like there is this accusation of something that shouldn't be happening. And it is something that just is and exists, as I say, but it's also something that we should recognize that that kind of centers one group and puts others on the margins. And in my case, it was, you know, Asian Americans on the margin.
Josie in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Josie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to reach out and say thank you for kind of bringing some of this into the public discourse. I mean, we're seeing so much more about Asian American, you know, the experience of Asian American and Asian immigrant populations here. My husband was a Chinese immigrant. He was raised in Korea, but was ethnically Chinese. And we were married for 12 years. He passed away very suddenly last year, very unexpectedly.
I'm sorry.
Leaving me with three very young kids. And so now I'm facing this as a white-presenting Native woman who, you know, already has my own cultural stuff to deal with, also raising kids who have this experience that I have no lived experience to support them through.
Right.
And it, with the rise of, you know, what we've seen since the pandemic, some of the, you know, anti-Asian sentiments, it's been really difficult to navigate that idea of how do I support my kids through this when, you know, there's just so much that I can't even begin to understand from their perspective without the support of my husband who had that experience and still navigating the, you know, the cultural distance. With my in-laws who don't, you know, my mother-in-law does not speak English, and how do we navigate grief in a time when we don't share a common language or a common culture?
Right. Thank you for that question. Again, I'm really sorry for your loss. I would say that probably the chapter that I wrote about my son and raising a mixed race child might be the most relevant to your circumstance. And first, I wouldn't sell yourself short, that I think that there's plenty that you can do. Obviously, you won't have a certain insider perspective that your husband would have had. But my advice is not to assume that that race isn't going to have a place in their lives, depending on how your kids present. So there's a line in my book where I talk about my two sisters, and we all married white people, and so we all have mixed race children. And I was just having a conversation with my sister the other day, and she was telling me how she's just beginning to realize how one of her sons was being bullied because he was Asian, right? He presents the most Asian, and she didn't know. And my nephew is 14. So I think there was this assumption on her part that wouldn't be a part of his life. And I don't sense that in your case, but asking those questions and then, seeking those resources would be the first step.
Yeah. Josie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. David Shee, our guest, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. His book, Chinese Prodigal, A Memoir in 8 Arguments. Again, you can join us. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer today, our on-air producer, Clara Neipert, Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking with our guest, David Shee, the author of Chinese Prodigal, A Memoir in 8 Arguments, a wonderful book, and I hope you have a chance to look at it. If you have questions for him or maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Talk about when you first considered yourself an Asian American.
Oh, right. This goes back to the chapter about Vincent Chin. And even now, Larry, I'll ask my students, I'll say, how many of you say the words Asian American to refer to a person or an issue once a week or more? And I get very few students who say they actually use the words Asian American. And it didn't surprise me because when you hear the words Asian American, you can usually bet that it's intentional, that somebody's making a statement, and Asian American is a political identity, and I didn't have that political awakening, if you will, until graduate school. And it wasn't until I talk about this in the Vincent Chin chapter, where I was just about to move to Michigan, where Vincent Chin was killed, and an Asian American friend, a Korean American, when he found out that I was going to graduate school in Michigan, he said, "Oh yeah, congratulations, Vincent Chin, man." And I didn't know what he meant, and I had to look up who Vincent Chin was, and I learned that story. Vincent Chin was a Chinese American man who was beaten to death by a white man named Ronald Ebens, a lot of people would say that the publicity of this case, because Ronald Ebens never spent a day in prison for this brutal murder, that the publicity of the case kind of galvanized all of these Asian American ethnic groups that saw themselves as separate from one another, but all began to think that they too, could have been a victim like Chin. And so you had this idea of being an Asian American as a political identity, right? As a group that could have political power, but also a group that shared the same vulnerabilities, right? The same vulnerability to being thought of as a foreigner and then being attacked for it, right? That's what kind of bound this group together. And it wasn't until my friend said that to me and I did that research that I began to think about myself in that way, too, because growing up, Larry, I just wanted to be an American, right? Like any kid, you just want to belong. And in fact, I really disliked it when I was with friends or even teachers and they wanted to talk about my having Chinese heritage. You know, I just didn't want to stand out in that way.
Talk about how we use race to separate people into groups. I think you locate Asian Americans somewhere between white and black at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really a major topic within the book. That is, I don't think that we can understand what it means to be Asian American unless we think about white identity and unless we think about black identity. And so many of the chapters have to do with that, especially the last one. And so, you know, you were talking about it at the beginning of the show that the book is about bridging cultures. And I would say that I would rephrase it a little differently. I'd say the book is about bridging histories rather than cultures. That is, I think the book is asking the readers to be aware of all of the racial histories in this country. In my book, I focus mostly on the histories of Asian, Black, and white people. And to see how they're all interrelated and how they all create meaning together. Because I think it's too simple to think about, you know, one of these groups in isolation having its own kind of insular culture and beliefs and meanings and not see how it's actually codependent on the meanings of these other groups. One example, for instance, would be the model minority stereotype, you know, which you might be familiar with, right?
Mm-hmm.
This idea that Asian Americans are overachievers. And that's critically connected to the history of black protest and liberation in this country, because it was only when that was happening during the 60s did you have this stereotype of the law-abiding, educated Asian American.
Yeah. I wanted to also talk about culture through food.
Yeah.
And and you know, this is a serious book. You write about race and racism. You're writing about power. You're writing about assimilation. But Chinese, your thoughts on Chinese food and American culture?
I knew I wanted to have a book. I mean, sorry, a chapter on food, but probably not the chapter that that people would expect from a Chinese American, right? Because I think Chinese people in this country are too closely associated with food, right? And one of the lines that I have from that chapter is, Asian food, like Asian people, is never not probationary in this country. And so I talk about popular culture, right? And the ways that Asian Americans become like victims of racism by the way that they're associated with food that wouldn't be acceptable, right, or appetizing to people who aren't Asian. And I wanted to turn that idea on its head. So it's really a chapter about food ways, where there's the stereotype of Asian food having too much MSG, and of course, you know, the most, I would say, damaging and racist stereotype about Asian people eating dogs and cats, right? I talk about those. And those are almost kind of accepted as food ways by the dominant culture. But I said, you know, let's kind of reflect upon the food ways of other cultures. And so one point I make is that all of the racist tropes about Asian food have been anticipated by, you know, the racist tropes about black food ways. But then I say, well, let's take a look at the history of eating in this country for white people. And I talk about segregated restaurants. And I talk about this one photograph of three civil rights workers, Ann Moody, Joan Trumpower, and John Hunter Gray. You know, where, I know you might remember it, Larry, they're sitting at this diner in Jackson, Mississippi, and there are white diners pouring ketchup, mustard, and sugar all over them. It's a very famous photo. And I make the point that that's an American food way too, right? So let's talk about, you know, segregation as a food way if we're going to talk about what Asian people eat as a food way. And, you know, the conclusion that I come to is that anti-Asian racism about food is really an anxiety about status, that whenever somebody asks you, for instance, if you've ever eaten a dog, they're trying to kind of figure out right now, you know, how they exist in relation to you, how far they can go with you, right? They're trying to see, you know, how the two of you stand.
You know, in that same chapter, you say that Americans worry too much about the origin of what we put into ourselves and not enough about the origin of what is already there.
That's right. And, you know, I think I say it's not, you know, the mark of a culture is not what we eat, but how we eat.
Talk a bit more about the, I think you call it empathic fallacy.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so the empathic fallacy, that's an idea that you can overcome racism by telling a story that brings people to understand the situation and experiences of another group. Right. And it's a fallacy because it doesn't really work. Right. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, if you read a book about Asian Americans, that you don't become more sympathetic to Asian Americans, because that can certainly happen. But I don't think that you can do it in one shot. Right. Like, I don't think that you can read a book and then suddenly become somebody that you're not. The empathic fallacy is not accurate for that reason. I would say that what I really wanted for readers of this book is not to learn necessarily about Asian Americans, because I'm only just one,
yeah.
Larry. I think my experience is fairly representative, which is why I talk about all of these other people and events from history. But you know, what I tell my students when I teach, say, an Asian American literature class is I say, you're going to learn about Asian Americans. Don't worry about it. You're going to learn about Asian American history. And you're going to know a lot more than you did before you took this class. But I would feel like the class is somewhat of a failure if you don't learn more about yourself than you learn about Asian Americans. That's the goal of every class I teach. That's the goal for the book. In one chapter about reading, I say that books are like private Rorschach tests. That you read a book, and Larry, you took something out of it, but yeah. Maybe you talked to your producer, and your producer didn't remember that part, or they liked another chapter a lot better. Well, you know, you both created a particular meaning for that book that has everything to do with who you are. And so what I would hope from readers is that they come in expecting to learn more about me as an Asian American, but also open to learning more about themselves and the ideas that they've come to believe and whether or not they want to believe those anymore.
Yeah. You also say in that chapter, reading a book can be confused with finishing it.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I taught Moby Dick back in the day. I haven't done it for a while, but and that has everything to do with the book being more about the reader than the subject. That's what I believe. So that I really want my students to stop reading and reflect upon what they've just read if it deeply moves them. Because they're just on the cusp of learning something important about themselves. I mean, if you're crying while you're reading a book and reading a chapter, you probably should put down the book and think about why you're crying, and to sit with that for a moment. And I think the book is structured in a way that allows for that to happen at the reader's pace. That is, you know, as I say, it's a memoir and essay. So if you wanted to read about mixed race children, if you wanted to read about marrying a white person as an Asian American, if you wanted to read about police violence or affirmative action or hate crimes or food, then you can read that one chapter and you don't have to, you know, read everything that came before it or came after it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I chuckled when I got into that chapter because for the program, I might read in the course of a year 50 books.
Wow.
And at 40 to 50, and then I'll probably read another 40 or so of my own that just read for, you know, my own interest or whatever. So I read a lot of books. And your book, I think, has done a lot for me. Because it has caused me to think about all of what you just talked about,
mm-hmm.
and where I fit, and what assumptions that I've made that were not, you know, caused me to think, why did you assume that, or why did you do that particular thing? So for me, yours is a really good book because it's made me think a whole lot about myself.
Yeah.
How do you hope your son will feel about having Chinese ancestors?
He likes it. You know, I think it gives him a sense of identity and he's come to embrace it. And it's something that I'm really thankful for. Obviously, I had an influence over that, but you know, at the same time, you're kind of having to counter the dominant culture around him, right? You know, at school or with his friends. One of the points that I wanted to make in that chapter about him was that I wanted him to know that he was half Chinese, not really for the sake of culture, although that's important, but for the sake of anti-racism, that I wanted him to know that he was a person of color, and there's a certain identity that goes along with that in this country and a certain responsibility. But I'll also say, Larry, I'm really glad that you found some humor in this book.
Oh, yeah.
Because I wanted it to be there. And I think sometimes when you read memoirs, especially memoirs by writers of color, there's this sense that you're not allowed to laugh, right? like it's too serious. You're dealing with these kind of serious issues of racism and war. And one of the things I wanted to do in this book is to say there was a lot of love in my family, Larry. Like yes, you know, there were some really difficult times and regrets. But it's not a book where my identity is defined by trauma, right? Which is sometimes the message that we get from representations of Asian American family life, right? In popular culture, that there was a lot of humor and there was a lot of happiness and joy.
You're such a good writer. You know, just to go along with that, I went back and after reading the book, I went back to a page before the book begins and after thinking about your relationship with your dad and my own relationship with my own dad, you quote, have this wonderful quote from James Baldwin. If the relationship of father and son could really be reduced to biology, the whole earth would be blaze with the glory of fathers and sons.
That's right. When I saw that, I said, okay, I got my epigraph. That's it, right?
Oh man. Well, are you surprised? I mean, your book has been out. It's only been out, you know, a few months, but it's gotten some really good reviews, and it was named an Amazon Best Book of the Month.
Yeah, I'm really thankful for that because it was a risk, right? This is a non-traditional memoir. Mm-hmm. And you never know how people will respond to your life. And I think that there are some ideas in there. As I said, you know, each chapter is trying to make a point. And it's, you know, it's very possible that readers might disagree with that point. I think, you know, I think I make it in a compelling way. So I'm just very thankful that the way that I describe my life and the way that I talk about Asian American identity and race and racism resonates with readers.
And what's the response? I wondered what the response was from your family or friends who have read the book.
Yeah, that was tough, Larry. It was really difficult to write, you know, about. I couldn't have written the book when my father was still alive. You know, I started it right after he passed away, but still I had to write about my mother. I had to write about my mother's family. I had to write about my wife and her family and my friends from growing up, you know, who I love. But, you know, if you're going to write about growing up in an era where the ideas that we have about race and racism aren't as well-defined, right, that there was, you know, a lot more kind of openly racist thinking and talking, and you still want to tell the truth, you know, you have to tell those stories and then take your chances, right? Otherwise, you're hiding something. And I just told my friends and my family, you know, I hope you understand that if it seems like I'm saying something that might be hard on you, the whole book, I feel like I'm hardest on myself, that I wouldn't tell a story for its own sake, that it has to reflect somehow on my own growing up and education.
By the way, I liked your cover, and I looked at the back, and I see it was a photograph that you had supplied, and so that's got to be you as a very young person, and I couldn't figure out who the woman was in the photo.
Yeah, that's the server at a restaurant. I don't know if you remember, Larry. It's kind of bigger on the West Coast, but we had one in Dallas. It's called Farrell's. It was Farrell's Ice Cream Parlor, and it was this gay 90s themed ice cream parlor where they would bring out these huge dishes of ice cream, but everybody would have handlebar mustaches and suspenders. And so this was probably not my birthday party, maybe a party for one of my sisters. But what I love about the photo, Larry, is probably about 9 years old, is that it's like the most Asian picture I could have found of myself, which is because I'm not smiling. And I just love it that, you know, that somebody's putting food in front of me and it's just this very serious, you know, Asian face accepting it, which, you know, would be in honor of my parents. Yeah.
You have some appearances coming up. I know you're going to be speaking at Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire.
Yep. So I've got appearances coming up in Eau Claire, one on the 12th and one on the 27th. And then I've got appearances at the Central Wisconsin Book Festival in Wausau. Got one in the Wisconsin Book Festival in Madison. And then there's others coming up. If folks want to come out and see me read, they can go to my website, which is davidshee.com, and it'll list all of my appearances. And I'd love to connect with other people and organizations who'd like to hear me talk more about Chinese Prodigal.
Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed your book, and it's been a real pleasure talking with you, David. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I hope you sell a million.
Thank you, Larry. This was a real pleasure.
David Shee, professor of English at the UW Eau Claire, and his book, Chinese Prodigal, a memoir in 8 arguments. Take a look at it. I think you're going to enjoy it. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at the challenges that first-generation students faced. Are you a first-generation student for college? I was a first generation. We'll find out some more about that coming up next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.